Welcome to our Open Source Startup Podcast. This is Tim from Essence VC and our lovely co-host, Ravi from Cowboy Ventures. And this episode, we're so excited to have Samuel from Pydantic. And Pydantic is a data validation library. It has huge amount of downloads. So we're super excited to have Samuel on our podcast. So welcome, Samuel.
Thanks so much. Yeah, very excited to be here.
Awesome. So I actually think you were the first data validation company that we've had on the podcast. So I think a good place to start would be like, what is data validation? What does Pydantic do?
That's a very good question. Because we're just a library, we have to do some kind of inference about how people use us. And to an extent, we don't know. But effectively, in Python, as in other languages like JavaScript, about 5 to 10 years ago, people started to find the flexibility of those languages frustrating. And so type ints came along. So type ints are some extra code you add into your code, which basically tells another person who's reading the code or some static analysis tools what kind of type you expect for a given variable. So you might expect it to be an integer or a float or a dictionary object in JavaScript. And those type annotations are really helpful. They help you avoid lots of bugs. Problem is, when you come to real-world data, they have no effect because they're just there as an annotation, as a hint at what it should be. So what's clever about Pydantic is that we take those type hints and we effectively provide you a way to enforce them. So if I say that first name needs to be a string, it will be a string. If I say email address needs to be a string and it needs to match an email address format, then we can do that. And on into like arbitrarily complex different data structures. And people take Pydantic and then they do a whole range of things with it. Sebastian Ramirez, my friend, has FastAPI, which is a massively well-known web framework that uses Pydantic to validate request data. So when you make a request to his web server, it will check that the values are how they should be. But then lots of other people use Pydantic for a whole range of other stuff. So for example, NASA use Pydantic to validate the data they get from James Webb to prepare the images. The UN uses Pydantic to prepare the data that they release on climate change every quarter. Wherever you're using Python to work with real world data, people tend nowadays to like lean on Pydantic to make sure that they don't get all the simple bugs of the wrong type.
So I want to talk back to 2017. That's where you started Pydantic, right? And I think this idea that we're going to add validations to Python, like, it's not new, but I think 17 is kind of like an interesting time because I think type hints probably is there already. It's never been widely adopted or as love-hate relationship, I would just kind of say, in Muslim communities. And so maybe talk about why you started this and how did you get this project off the ground? Because you have a lot of downloads now. This is really, maybe you can talk about like sort of the early numbers and what's the current like traction. But to focus on the early days, what is the starting point you started and how did you get people to know about this project and grow from there?
That's a good question. I wish I could answer the second bit well. Pydantic started off for me as an experiment in a file in an existing project. I was just frustrated that these type ins were there. They made my code look nice. I got rid of the tildes underneath variables as I fixed typing errors. But when it came to hit something in the real world, they meant nothing. And I kind of started off as an experiment. Could I do something with them? Uploaded that to PyPI a few days later, put it on Hacker News, and it got like a bit of attention, but nothing crazy. And then, you know, I maintained a few other open source packages. None of them have ever, you know, some of them are reasonably widely used now, but nothing has like taken off over the next few years like Pydantic did. And I think it was lots of other people had that same frustration I did, that like type ins were there. They seemed really useful, but they didn't do anything. And so it was useful to kind of give them teeth and like find a way to enforce them. And then Sebastian came along in, I think, 2018 or 2019 and built FastAPI. That definitely contributed to excitement around Pydantic. I think there's a lot of people who hear about FastAPI first, start using it, love FastAPI, but also find other applications for Pydantic that go beyond just that like web server application. Short answer, I don't know why Pydantic has been as successful as it has. We were definitely right place, right time with type ints, like you say. I'm quite pragmatic about how Pydantic should and does work. I think that there is a tension in software development between correct, perhaps sometimes leaning towards building software for other software developers who are as experienced as you are, and on the other end of the spectrum, doing stuff that's simple and easy to get your head around, even if it's not always as computer science correct. trying to remember what it was like to be a junior developer or someone who doesn't know anything about this particular library and make it easy to get started with. And that's something that I think Sebastian, who I was talking about, is amazing at. And it's something that I don't know if I'm particularly good at it, but it's something I take really seriously. I think that like thinking about how do we make the first, I always talk about like the first 30 seconds, you should understand what something does. First 3 minutes, you should start to find it useful. And after 300 hours, you shouldn't be driven around the bend by it. And if you can hit like those three like milestones, you're in luck. So that's how I think about it. And then in terms of the downloads, yeah, to be like numerical about these things, Pydantic was growing. It had got to about 5 million downloads a month at the beginning of, I always forget, either 20 or 21, 21, I think. And then something happened around, January 21. And basically the gradient of the increase of downloads just completely changed. And now we have something like 85, 87 million downloads a month, which is a like crazy number. We're hopefully later this month, although working out exactly when is going to be quite hard, we're going to hit the billion downloads number, which will be a nice moment. But yeah, Pydantic's usage has just like continued to rocket ever since something changed in the beginning of 21.
So I'd love to walk through your thought process, because at the time you were running another company that was an ed tech company. And then I believe you didn't start Pydantic, the company, until 2022. So can you kind of walk us through what happened between 2021, it takes off, you're at like another company, just your thought process around like, okay, do I want to go and focus on Pydantic full time? Is there like a true company potential there? Like, how did you think about that?
Yeah, again, it was more like luck and random than me being particularly like deliberate about this. But yeah, I started Pydantic back in 2017. It like grew organically kind of up until beginning of 21, like I said, and then the like gradient increased. Fast forward to like April 2022, I had worked at a few different companies, but I'd had a like quite hard time at a company I didn't enjoy working for, left them and thought I would work on Pydantic full-time for a bit. I had this big plan to rewrite Pydantic's core in Rust, and I optimistically thought that was going to take me a few months. It predictably didn't. It took me rather longer. In fact, we released Pydantic V2 with the Rust backend, I guess, about a month ago now. So I was working on that, and the plan had been to finish Pydantic V2 and then go and start a company not that closely related to Pydantic, but definitely leveraging its popularity and traffic, etc. And then Sequoia Bogomil emailed me out of the blue in November. And we had a few conversations initially around joining their ARC program. And then that I spoke to lots of other VCs and it became a proper seed round. And so, yeah, I raised the seed round from Sequoia, finished raising that in January. And then I've kind of grown a team since then. And now we're 7 people. We just released Pydantic V2, which I had been working on for like 18 months by the time we got it out. And now we're working on a mixture of the open source and commercial stuff.
Yeah, that's amazing. I think there's so many things we can talk about here. I'm actually still quite curious about like the growth numbers, because I think, like you mentioned, developers, you're frustrated, I think, because you are trying to build software that you're guaranteeing type safety, you know, and in this real programming world, everybody has like a different religion about what the programming language itself should do. Like, I imagine probably a lot of people shouting about like, if you want type safety, go use a type safety language. You know, don't use Python. It's meant to be dynamic in the first place, right? You know, I'm sure there's like never going to be like a pure approach. What do you think has happened that really get everybody wanting to use this and have the necessity to start using it? Because I think sometimes the type safety, like I mentioned, is just a hint, right? I just want to know. I just want to see, but it's not really ensuring anything. Now you're the gatekeeper, right? I want to make sure it actually is type. I actually make sure it actually is going through that sort of changes the nature of the program and the nature of how we deal with this language. Do you think something has changed in a macro wise? Like people are using Python in more critical things, or there's more specific applications have changed? What do you think macro wise have changed for the programmer mindset?
So it's interesting. I was hearing a developer at Meta, one of the like senior developers at Meta, who's also part of their contribution to the Python community, speaking at PyCon last year and talking about the Instagram code base, which was obviously massive, like 1 million lines of code, didn't have any type hints, and they built some tools to basically add type hints into it. lots of interesting stuff in there, but the particular insight I thought was fascinating. Someone asked him, what was the pushback from those in the Instagram team who didn't want to use Typeints? And basically, there was no one. There was no one who, on a code base of that size, was even pretending that Typeints weren't a good thing. When you're using Python for projects of that size, Typeints are, you know, a game changer. And actually, it turns out that once you got used to them, they're a game changer right down to much, much smaller applications. So I think that the journey was like, effectively, Python without Typeints had a whole bunch of problems. We apply these Typeints. Now we have them here, but we still have this frustration that we need to write a whole nother bunch of logic or use a different library to enforce those types. Oh, it turns out there's this library, Pydantic, which can just go and take care of that. So effectively, we add Typeints anyway, and then we get data validation using them for free on top. The other thing I think I would say is, and this is much fuzzier and less clear, but I think there's been a transition over perhaps the last 10 years in terms of people kind of pulling back from the everything's dynamic, anything goes, to actually wanting the guardrails that you get. So for example, there was a point where NoSQL was going to be the solution to everything. It turned out people didn't always like NoSQL. One of the reasons was that, like, actually it turns out having a schema defined by your database stops a whole class of problem. In JavaScript, everything went, except it turns out that's an enormous frustration and leads to a whole bunch of problems. So TypeScript came along and started to solve that problem. I think, you know, the same thing happened in Python. People love the dynamicness. They love the fact that they don't have to follow the Typeint, but it's awfully useful to have it there. And once you've got them in there, once you've got these like optional guardrails, I guess you might call it, it makes complete sense to extend their use into like the boundaries of your application, whether that's boundary with some other Python code, boundary with an API, boundary with some files you're reading off disk, whatever it might be. Pydantic takes care of that. I said I was about the pragmatic side of Pydantic earlier. One of the things that lots of people had a problem with in V1 and that we've sort of fixed in V2 is that Pydantic leans towards being lax or coercing types. So if you have an integer field and you pass the string 123 to it, Pydantic by default will coerce that string into 123. And we'll do some other like obvious coercions from bytes to strings, et cetera, et cetera. People found that very frustrating in V1 in some cases, and we now have strict mode where that won't happen. But like the number of cases where that just solves problems for you, you didn't even know existed. Because obviously, if you're reading a CSV file, everything is a string to start with. So it's incredibly helpful if numbers just get parsed automatically, or byte fields can automatically be constructed from strings, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think that pragmatism, that like willingness to coerce values to basically guarantee the output format rather than try and strictly validate the input format is another reason that Pydantic has been successful, because like I say, it just allows people to get on with their day job without having to think about a bunch of relatively dumb conversions.
I want to go back to something you said earlier and like, why rebuild some of the core logic in Rust? And like, what was the thought process there?
Number of different things. One, Pydantic is, as I say, downloaded whatever it is, 80 something million times a month. It's run by all of FANG, by 19 of the top 25 companies in NASDAQ. I don't know how many like clock cycles worldwide are devoted to running Pydantic every day, but I'm going to take a guess that it's not a particularly small number. And so it's a minority of users of Pydantic who need improved performance, but everyone benefits from it in some way. Whether it's just that they're sitting there twiddling their thumbs for a bit less time while their script runs, whether it is that their cloud bill goes down. But then also there's the macro argument that like it in its tiny way reduces the energy consumption of the cloud. And while that's obviously a tiny percentage of the cloud, it's quite big relative to one person or one team. So that's part of it with the performance angle. And then we had a bunch of improvements we wanted to make in Pydantic strict mode, which I just talked about being one of them. Whilst I love Python, Python's super useful for lots of things. It turns out that the internals of what Pydantic does, this like very strict, ordered way of validating data, which is highly complex, Python isn't necessarily the language that's best suited to that, whereas Rust works brilliantly for that. So in a sense, we've got to rebuild a bunch of Pydantic anyway. Is there a better way to do that? And sure enough, while it took probably longer in Rust, it was the right decision.
One aspect of developer tools I'm always super intrigued on, and we might even spend the whole episode, but probably not. We're trying to keep it short. You said the key for Pydantic winning has been developer experience. Like the developer experience quality is just way higher than any other approaches. And I often talk to so many developer products founders, and they always say they love to be the best developer experience, but really people actually deliver it, right? And so what is the philosophy for you? How did you determine what's the best developer experience? Like, what are the things you did? You put constraints on yourself when you kind of do things? Did you have certain like ways you want user consume it? Because you talk about 30 seconds. I'm assuming that's not just the library itself, but maybe the website or documentation. Talk about like, your approach, the developer experience. How do you maintain that? What is that bar you're trying to maintain? And how do you make sure it's the best quality here?
So I think there's a spectrum from where I am, where I think that the power of empathy in API design is incredibly important. This idea of trying to remember what it was like to not know how something works and thereby make it easy for someone who's just getting used to it. In the middle, you have most developers who just build the thing that they want to use without really thinking about it. And then at the worst end of the spectrum, you have those developers who go and build an API to prove how knowledgeable and intelligent they are. And they build, in my opinion, the worst APIs of all. My belief is basically that an expert, a like staff level engineer, has an awful lot in common with someone who started coding 3 weeks ago. The difference is that the staff level engineer will get something much more quickly. But basically, if you can make something easy to use for someone who's inexperienced, you get all of those people who are inexperienced, who are the vast majority of the developer community, but you also help the expert in a hurry who just needs to get something done, who isn't going to spend months learning Pydantic, who just needs to modify a model to change a data type and then get on with the rest of their job. So it's that like willingness to do things the like dumb, obvious, simple way. And sometimes that involves making compromises. It involves not always necessarily doing the most performant thing. It involves not always doing the most correct thing in computer science terms. As in, if you think about the word validation, and if you say this field is an integer, and someone passes a string to it, the correct thing to do is to raise an error. It is in some sense a bodge and an inaccuracy to try and coerce strings that match a decimal format into an integer. But it's awfully helpful in lots and lots of scenarios. So it's that like pragmatism, that willingness to like break the rules of computer science sometimes to make something that people you think on balance will find easier to use. And then say, if you really want that strict check, we'll provide you a way to do it.
So one of the things that I think is really interesting about what I've read about Pydantic is just how community-centric the company is. Like everything from the survey that you have to try to get feedback on the roadmap to just like having hundreds of contributors. Can you talk a bit about your like philosophy and building in a very open source way? Because there are a lot of open source founders we'll talk to that like they're maybe the core project they're working with is open source, but the way they build is much closer to a typical SaaS company. But like, what's kind of your philosophy around how to build and how to really engage the community deeper than we see a lot of founders?
To be clear, not all the things we're going to build are going to be open source long term. We are going to build closed source offerings. And I think that like, that's a reasonable thing to do. We've raised VC money. We're expected to make extraordinary returns, grow at extraordinary rates. That's the VC model. I think that there are some companies where that works to remain truly open source, but in the vast majority of cases, you have to cut some corners, you have to change license, you have to have components that are not open source. I think that like the biggest open source contribution Pydantic, the company, will make will be Pydantic, the library, and then we will build tools and services for people that some of which are closed source, some of which are open. In terms of the roadmap, we had a number of different things we were working on building. We had some pretty active discussions within the team about which ones we wanted to build. And it seemed like we had this enormous resource of like really experienced people who were engaged, who were prepared to read an article, think about it, and then fill in the survey that most people wouldn't have got. I mean, to be clear, when I sent the blog post plus the survey to some user experience expert, he was like, oh, this is completely unacceptable. No one will read it. You'll get no one filling in the survey. It's far too long. You can't get that. You need to ask like four questions and your like intro needs to be 200 words. And I was like, I've just got a feeling that we'll go ahead with this and see what happens. And sure enough, we had an incredible response. And we still have, essays from people. People wrote like 2,000 words in the like comments box on what they wanted. Because they've, these people work day to day with Pydantic. People are incredibly engaged in it. And one of the things that's different between Pydantic and some other open source libraries is that Pydantic is kind of developer facing. If you're working with Fast API or Hugging Face or any of these libraries or frameworks that have Pydantic as a dependency, we're not deep down in a requirements file. You only find out when we're broken. If you're using Pydantic every day and you have opinions, and sure enough, I'm sure there are those out there who dislike it. But like, obviously what we hear from is the vocal community of people who seem to really like it. Yeah, we have people who have strong opinions, and leveraging that seemed like a no-brainer to me.
I think one key audience that you mentioned in most of the early blog posts around your fund announcements and stuff is really web developers. Because Python is not just web developers. Like, it has been a large amount of people, but web developers is probably the most keyword used over and over and over. Even in a TechCrunch article, mentioned Fast API to be the large part contributing to your growth. So I guess, talk about like your integration and community, like when it comes to how you see your growth happens. Was Fast API and the web developer side of the world, is that like a conscious choice that you are familiar with and you went with it? Or this is like 10, 20 things I've tried and this is something that one kind of surprisingly grew? How did that, this large part consisting of adoption happened in the journey?
Yeah, lots of open source founders or open source founder is itself a like somewhat loaded term, right? Because there are lots of people now who are rightly and sensibly trying to build VC or companies off the back of open source. And they will talk about organic growth. But there's something quite different between organic growth, where there's a team of people pushing something, and organic growth in the sense of basically unsupervised growth, which is what most of Pydantic's lifetime has been. It was up there, but I had another job. I was, you know, replying to a bunch of issues when I had time, but Pydantic was really growing on its own. People would come along and like add new significant features because they wanted them. And sure, it's different now. We have a team of people and we, you know, we try and be more active in replying to the issue tracker. But like the vast majority of Pydantic's growth has been like unsupervised organic. And so it's, in some sense, it's found its niches by mistake or without like deliberate input from me or anyone else. In terms of the web development thing, my guess is that from download numbers that about 25% of Pydantic's usage is through Fast API. Another 25% is in the web context. And then the other 50% of usage is everything else. And that's where it gets much harder to know how Pydantic is used. So there are some like vector databases that use Pydantic as a validation layer. There is a bunch of ML tools and there's a number of different integrations with OpenAI that use Pydantic. But all of these add up in terms of download count to a tiny percentage. It's very hard to know how Pydantic is used when you look at like big organizations like HSBC or JP Morgan. You see the traffic to the docs from their internal systems, but how they're using it, who knows? And I suspect that those like, you know, for example, NordVPN use Pydantic. Basically, they have all of their infrastructure is defined in code in Pydantic models. And then when they want to update their infrastructure, they're effectively performing validation with those Pydantic models as part of running the code. I suspect that like an enormous amount of Pydantic's usage is in a myriad of other things that aren't web, but they don't fit as nicely into a bucket as like web or data pipelines or ML or something like that.
I'm curious, with so much usage and a lot of usage that is just really hard to track, when you're thinking about the paid product and who to build that for and what use cases to build that for, like, where are you getting that data from and how are you thinking about that? Because the community is so big, you could build for so many different like types of users or size of companies.
Yeah. And then it's definitely a hard question. We have a kind of like embarrassment of riches in terms of the number of different directions to go in. Without going into too much detail, I mean, I can talk about what our roadmap said, which is, you know, we talked about observability. If you talk about starting an observability company called Pydantic, it definitely seems quite a long way away from how most people think of us. But I think one of the things that we've realized since starting the company is that the data validation layer sits at the center of lots of people's applications. And if you can hook into that to do, whether it be business intelligence, whether it be like developer style observability or analytics, product analytics, where the data validation is going on is actually a super useful place to do that. But also, Pydantic as a brand is now known and respected and I hope trusted by a large number of developers, not just web developers, but you know, in lots of different places. And so we have a good opportunity there to go and effectively provide them useful tools that I think the same group of people starting from scratch without that brand would have a harder time selling. We also talked about the kind of, I suppose you might describe it as the like ad hoc data warehouse, the like data validation layer on the front of S3, there's like enormous amount going on in that world. And it's, you know, it's changing very quickly. There's big opportunities, but it's also in some ways a bit less clear exactly what's going to win out, how people are going to be processing their data in 5 or 10 years' time. The schema catalog component is a really interesting one because it fits exactly with where people think of Pydantic. I think the schema catalogs until now are slightly a chocolate teapot for lots of people because you have this thing which is supposed to be a definition of record of how my schemas look. But like, if that's not what the developers are actually using, it doesn't really mean much. So if the source of truth is a Pydantic model that's also being used for validation, a schema catalog like that would be way more useful. The last idea was this idea that within small applications, you can have one or two Pydantic models that define everything from user interface to database, which is an idea I've been like ruminating on for years and was actually one of the ideas that I originally started the company thinking about. But like, it was obvious from the survey that that's not where most people are excited about what we can do.
The roadmap is really, I think, what's the most intriguing, because everyone has different ways of figuring out what they want to build as a product or managed service, right? And given that you're a Python library, there's just so many choices. Obviously, you already hinted you're going to add in more languages, but not a lot, right? And all these roadmap, I'm looking at your roadmap, component deep dives at least. These are like related, but not so overlapping, or pretty much not overlapping products. And so what is your approach to think about how do you prioritize or decide? Because some of the target users are pretty different, like analytics for Python is one kind of usage, dashboards or UI is probably another one, gateways. Is there a way that you have an audience that you already honed down to and then you're going to prioritize for them that? Or is it truly democracy at its fullest, like everybody go votes?
No, it's not democracy because in the end, I want to build things I know I want to use because I think that's like the most acid test. I kind of had three rules when I started a company. One was be your own customer, as in not have to go and ask someone else whether or not this thing looks useful. Recurring revenue is a no-brainer. I think running a non-recurring revenue business is just much less good for your mental health than running one where if everything stays still, you get the same money in next month as last. And then finally, try and have lots of small customers rather than a few big customers. But that third one, I'd happily throw away if someone comes along and offers us lots of money. But the first two, like, be your own customer and recurring revenue, I think were quite important to me. So the first question for me is like, would I use it? Does it look useful? Does it make sense? And then after that comes, will other people use it? What's the like revenue potential? All the other questions.
And I imagine when you were going through your fundraise process, there was a lot of thinking about, okay, like what can Pydantic become long-term? I think in your fundraising announcement, it said something along the lines of a Heroku-like service long-term, but when you think about like the future potential, like where do you see Pydantic like 4 or 5 years from now?
So I still believe completely in the principle that I described in that company announcement, which is that if you start building like components of the cloud, but putting developer experience first, building them like you're building a B2C product where you care that much about the experience, but instead the C, the customer is developers working for companies, there's an enormous potential in that. I think if you look at what Stripe have done, right? Like if you had gone to someone in 2010 and you had said, the problem with PayPal is the developer experience, they would, I guess, most likely have laughed at you and been like, no, it's all about margin and whether or not the like payment experience is good for the customer. It turned out that the person who actually was the gatekeeper of whether or not you would install a payment provider was the developer. And so it turned out that if you made the experience for the developer an order of magnitude easier than what went before, you had the most enormous opportunity. I would say that Vercel have done the same thing in like, you know, deployment. And so I think that like, in some sense, it doesn't matter where we start. I think that like, if you were to take basically every product and service that AWS, Google Cloud, Azure offer, you could rethink them all to be with developer experience as the like North Star and compete. I'm not saying we're going to go and compete on every single one of them in the near term, but like it's effectively, you know, choose which of those is the richest pasture.
I think a lot of open source projects, companies have very different kinds of like traction and community overall, right? Some started with the company, some have maybe a little bit of downloads, but in your case, you have a lot of downloads, like a lot of users. So I'm sure this choices of how do you actually figure out one is one that you should work on open source side and how to even like hone down the focus on your product side. do you try to like sample across your audience on terms of different types of company sizes and different types of nature of work to understand their needs and take that approach here? Or do you have more like an intuitive sense of, okay, this is the type of people I know better and I'm going to, based on my own need and my own experiences, do you do both? Or how do you actually able to tell what your users really want?
Yeah, so we did a bunch of that in the survey and we asked a bunch of questions about size of company and industry and all that kind of stuff. It turns out there was no particularly strong correlation with what people wanted. You know, if you look at, we go back to Fast API, right? It's like some people even describe it as low code. I wouldn't describe it as low code myself, but like Fast API has been awesomely successful by making it incredibly simple to start building a web service. And there are people who would still say it now. Go back 15 years, you would have looked at a web service like Fast API built by one guy who's not from California, and you would have said that's never going to be used by anyone serious. Well, it turns out today when Microsoft want to build a microservice within Office, what do they turn to? Fast API. And so actually the things that big companies want and all the engineers within large organizations want match very closely what individual developers or developers in small companies want. Sure, there are some exceptions to that. There are some bits of database technology that only really come into their own when you're massive scale. But the vast majority of like day-to-day get something built is the same whether or not you're a bank or a pre-seed startup. And so it's just about making it incredibly quick and easy for developers to get started and make it as hard as possible for them to shoot themselves in the foot. And if you can start doing that, I think there's like enormous opportunity. And actually, so like, who's your target in terms of company size doesn't matter that much in terms of the technology. I'm sure it makes a difference down the line when you need to have a go-to-market and you need sales teams and you need to think about like compliance and all that stuff. And I'm sure that you speak to me in a year and a half's time, 2 years' time, I'll be sweating and worrying about those things. But in terms of the technology, I really don't think that there's a big difference.
When you thought about building out your team for Pydantic, because developer experience is so, so important to the company, and I think a lot of companies say it's important to them, but there's just a different level of importance put on it.
Yeah.
Like, what were some of the things that you've screened for? I think, how big is the team now?
Eight Seven engineers? People now.
Do they all come from the community? Or like, what things did you look for as far as just like folks who are really going to be aligned and think about developer experience to the degree that you do?
So all but one of our engineers I knew already when we started the company because of they had contributed to either Pydantic or other like open source Python packages that I really respected. So the vast majority of the hiring was either people I knew getting in touch and saying, I see you've got some opportunities, or literally people who, you know, when I realized I was going to raise this money, I sent them an email and said, any chance you might want to, you know, leave what you're doing now and come and work with me. So in some sense, they had already been screened for caring about developer experience. But the funny thing is that like, you know, it's good and bad. All developers care about developer experience sort of by definition. And so the challenge is not actually in finding developers who care about developer experience. It's in getting a bunch of developers to agree on what good developer experience or what the right product actually means. And the glory of Pydantic is we've been able to hire a team of engineers who are, I think, would be the envy of most companies, even much bigger than us, because of, you know, Pydantic's reputation.
And what has been the hardest challenge or lesson you have to learn starting from an open source project and also a company? You know, I'm sure this is definitely a journey already. And even though you're still working a lot on the Pydantic sort of like the community side, I'm sure the way you look at this project, the way you have to start thinking on things are so different now. What has been like the hardest things you have to like really learn?
I think that like we've been very lucky so far. I mean, we're very early on. We haven't got anything commercial. We haven't made any money or indeed in some sense failed to make any money yet. So I think we're still in the honeymoon period in some ways. And, you know, mostly things have gone well. I definitely have moments of, I wouldn't say panic, but of anxiety about the trade-off between wanting Pydantic, the open source package, to be as good as possible, but also us migrating to work on the commercial stuff. And like, at what point do we kind of go cold turkey on open source and ignore it for a few months? I mean, that's what lots of open source packages do and they survive. But, you know, we might also lose enormous opportunities to make Pydantic even better and increase our install base, which in some level helps us. So I think that trade-off has already been and will continue to be a difficult thing. But I would say mostly we're still in the honeymoon period. So again, speak to me in 2 years and you might get a slightly like more real or blunter answer to that.
I love that, the startup honeymoon period. There are already so many nuggets that I think will be so useful for other founders in here. But we love to end on like pieces of advice that you wish someone gave you earlier on. So focus on like open source founders, but just advice from the first kind of like couple of years of your company building side of this journey.
So I think one of the things, and this is a slightly bearish thing to say to lots of open source founders, is that, and I've spoken to a few, I won't name any of them, but like people who are trying to build businesses around open source where they started the open source a few months ago. And that's great. And I wish them the best of luck. They're in a slightly different category to Pydantic, where, or even companies like, you know, Polars, who are much, much newer than us, but have already got enormous traction. We are incredibly lucky to have that enormous traction as a like bedrock for the company. And that you don't grow that overnight and you don't get an install base overnight. So like you have to accept that that's going to take time. Even if you build the best thing ever tomorrow, it'll still be 3 or 4 years before you're, you know, deep in the code base of lots of companies stuff. And then I think it wasn't until I started to raise money and tried to work out why Pydantic has been successful, but try to think about things in terms of what it would be like for someone who doesn't know as much as you, isn't as experienced, maybe isn't as natural a programmer even, and definitely doesn't know the internals of your library, and try and make it usable for them. And then in terms of much more practical considerations, having a word that no one had ever used before as your company name makes it incredibly easy to find where people are using it and search for it. So I didn't think about that at all at the time, but it's incredibly helpful to be able to find like Cisco's corporate document on open source packages that are used. And you can, you know, find that in Google because the name Pydantic is unique to us. Whereas if your library is called, you know, something much more generic, that's not as easy.
I love that. Great piece of advice to end on. This was fantastic, Samuel. Thank you so much for doing this with us.
Thank you very much. I've really enjoyed it.